When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome back to The Mason Jar here on the Circe Institute Podcast Network. I'm David Kern, and this being The Mason Jar, I am joined by the star of The Mason Jar, Cindy Rollins. Cindy, how's it going? Welcome back to your own show.
Thank you. It's been a while.
Yeah.
We've had some life has happened, but we're going to try to be more faithful here.
Yeah. So we've been talking about this, and I think, you know, for everyone listening, what we're going to do is we're going to try to bring you some kind of Mason Jar content every week. In the past, what we have done is we have done an interview episode towards the end of every month, and somewhere in the middle of the month, we've tried to do a Q&A episode where we answer your questions. But we're going to try to get an episode out every week where we discuss at least some piece of content related to Charlotte Mason, to homeschooling, to being a mom, to classical education, something related to one of those topics. And often they're going to be based on questions that you or I are receiving. And sometimes we'll sprinkle in interviews the same way we have been, but we want to try to get you some kind of piece of, you know, Mason Jar content every week. Sometimes that might mean that the episodes will be a little shorter than what you're used to. And sometimes they'll be, you know, more consistent with what you've been getting in the past. But we figured this way it's a little bit more of a manageable approach to getting you, to getting the listeners Mason Jar content every week. So we'll see how it goes. We can't promise it'll be every single week. You know, holidays will come up. People's children will have events going on, or there'll be some event that Cindy's speaking at or I'm going to, or something that makes it a little bit difficult. But our goal is to do almost every week is to give you some kind of Mason Jar, Charlotte Mason themed content. So that's the goal. You think we can do it? I think we can do it.
I think so. We'll see. We're gonna give it our best shot here.
we're gonna talk in a second about poetry and poetry anthologies and sources of poems and some of your favorites, your favorite resources for doing that. But before we dive all the way into that, I need to say a quick word from our friends over at the Institute for Excellence in Writing. Andrew Pudua is a good friend of both of ours, I think. And IEW provides teachers and teaching parents with methods and materials to aid them in training their students to become better listeners, speakers, readers, writers, and thinkers. To learn more about IEW and their lifetime 100% money-back guarantee, head over to IEW.com/start. And again, that's IEW.com/start. IEW makes some great resources for students of all sorts of ages and stages in terms of the writing life, I suppose, the writing process. So if you are in the market for something like that, then you can head over to IEW.com/start. My son just walked into the studio. What's up?
Hey, welcome to the Mason Jar.
What did you draw? Oh, thank you. Oh, it's a pen. Is it like a fountain pen?
Oh, this is your business suit, son.
It is. He came into the office with me today, and he's wearing a vest and a tie and a button-down shirt. So.
Oh boy, and he's drawing fountain pens. Wow.
Yeah, he's drawing fountain pens.
I have a fountain pen.
Are you going to sit in here with me? Okay, you got to try not to be too loud, okay? Here's a pen.
Well, he just draws pictures when he wants to show you what he wants. He wants a pen.
Yeah, I guess so. I hadn't thought about that before, but he's doing. Do you know the draw right now?
Yeah, we used to use that.
Yes,
we did.
He's been doing his draw right now stuff.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, all right, let's talk poetry anthologies.
Okay.
We got a question from someone asking whether you have a favorite poetry anthology or source of poems. And this questioner had mentioned that she's got some great books of really short young children's poems, but she finds herself completely overwhelmed when she starts trying to look at books of longer poems or poems designed for older children. I think that's probably pretty common.
Yeah,
experience.
Yeah.
Did you find that it was easier to work through or discover anthologies for younger children?
There are a lot of anthologies for younger children. I mean, every really great illustrator almost has come out with, you know, lots of those really beautiful children's anthologies. Mm. And some of those go up, you know, can take you a little way through middle school. Tasha Tudor has some. I have some great, you know, I always talk about the Childcraft poems of early childhood, volume one. I love that first. If you know, I know the question isn't about early childhood, but that is one of my favorites. So yeah, there are a lot more. There's actually more poetry books for older children or older humans than there are for children. But we don't see them as much, and they're not as prominent. I mean, if you go real old, the primo poetry volume for English is, of course, the Oxford Book of English Verse, and that is the edition you want to get. On that is any edition that is edited by Arthur Quiller Couch. I'd like to say Couch, and that's how it's spelled, but apparently his name is Quiller Couch. Or
that's a mouthful.
Yeah, or to make it simpler, just call him Q. and for those of you who have read my stuff and know how much I like Helene Hanth, who wrote the Charing Cross book, and she has she has a whole book on Q called Q's Legacy.
And so this is... That's an anthology for older, though, right?
An adult Oxford Book of English Verse. It's just the classic English literature book of poetry.
Okay.
So if you start in the beginning, it's going to have poems from the earliest, time period until by the end of the book. Now, this book I have is in the early 1900s because that's when Quiller Couch lived, and let's just go on and call him Q. So it ends at A.E. Housman, Francis Thompson. It doesn't have Blackmore. It doesn't go on towards, I don't even think it has any T.S. Eliot or anything like that.
Okay.
You really want to stick with this version of that particular book to get a huge, if you want to get an overview of English literature poems that have gone, have been the staples of English literature up until now. If my other favorite anthology, which is really the one I use the most, is the Classic 100 Poems by editor is William Harman. I absolutely adore this book. It takes all those poems out of the Oxford Book of English Verse, this huge massive anthology, and it brings it down to the 100 most anthologized poems in English literature. And it starts with the very, very early English time period with Sir Patrick Spence, which is an awesome poem. And it ends with the I'm trying to think, it ends with a very sad poem on...
Well, every anthology should end with a very sad poem.
Yes, it should.
That should just be a principle of anthology making.
Well, how sad is this? It ends with Dylan Thomas... A Refusal to Mourn the Death by Fire of a Child in London. Mm. So, doesn't get much sadder than that.
No kidding.
But yeah, so that's an excellent, that anthology gives you a little tiny lessons along with the poem that even just for a mom can like alert her to what's going on sometimes.
But by lessons, do you mean lessons kind of about the origin of the poem or lessons about the poem, like a moral?
Yeah, both. He tells when it's published, and then he might give some interesting notes. Like if it's in, many poems are written as a response to another poem. And so he alerts you to that sort of thing or to some other poems that might be similar or come from that same, genre or idea. Mm-hmm. And then at the very end, he might tell you what to listen for. And these are just short one or two paragraph things. And then at the very end, he'll tell you what the form of the poem is. For this poem, The Solitary Reaper, he says it's an 8-line stanza rhyming either A, B, C, B, D, D, E, E, or A, B, C, C, D, D with, tetrameter. I don't know how to say those words with the proper emphasis. And now that I think about it, but
I've heard various people say them in various ways, so I wouldn't worry too much about
it. Yeah. So it's like Greek. You just, hopefully you pronounce the right syllable. Give the emphasis on the right syllable. But anyway, it kind of alerts you to what's going on in the poem. I love when he tells you what the form is, because that can, over time, you start to see patterns, and that's very helpful. Mm.
Okay, so I guess my follow-up question then is, so you have these anthologies, you've gone on Amazon or found them at your used bookstore or wherever you got them, you've got them on your shelf, but now you've actually got to figure out what does that look like for how I use them with my kids. So your kids are probably past the early childhood poems and, they're starting to read, the Tennysons, the Longfellows, the Wordsworths, the Keats, the Yeats, the Dylan Thomases. And how did you go about actually employing those in your schooling? Were you letting them choose what they wanted to read, trying to kind of let them carve out the poetry, their own taste, maybe out of a certain set of parameters that you've kind of curated? Or are you, these books are very long, there's hundreds of poems. So are you curating very specific ones? How did you go about, what was your strategy for using them,
Well, with the classic 100 poems, since it's only 100, I would just read one poem a day out of that and discuss it with the kids. So it's very, so in 100 days of school, it may take you the whole school year, because maybe someday, you had a dentist appointment or, you just didn't have poetry that day. But I would just read a poem a day out of something. You can go straight through a book like this. William Harmon also has the classic 500 poems. So if you wanted something a little more meaty, there is the book by Laura Berquist, The Harp and the Laurel Wreath.
Yeah, that was going to be the one that I mentioned.
Yeah. So that's that's perfect for this sort of thing. And because that's also great for most of those poems are poems you might want to memorize. So, so that's beyond just reading the poems. The classic 100 poems, you can find poems to memorize in here easily. There's several Shakespeare sonnets and there's all kinds of poetry. But these might just also be poems you want to read. And I think there are poems that we're going to read and there are poems that we're going to memorize.
How do you determine the difference between those two
if I wanted the kids to memorize it, for whatever reason, we memorized it.
It's it tickles your fancy.
Yeah. If I found a poem that I really liked and that goes back and forth too, because like last year, I had poems that my student was memorizing and then his dad had a poem that he had found that he wanted him to memorize. And so he really responded well to that. Oh, he really wanted to get that poem right for his dad.
Yeah.
And such a great job on that. And he put a lot of heart and soul into just, instead of just memorizing it and saying it, he actually, added some kind of acting along with it. And it went really well. So, and then, the older students are doing, like when I was working with my high school kids, they were always doing George Grant's King's Meadow curriculum. Mm-hmm. So we did that almost exclusively through all our high school years. And he always has a poem to be memorized each, say, three terms or every 8 weeks, maybe. Maybe there's four terms. And usually those are some pretty difficult. He has some Milton and something. So for those, when I was using that, I would just do what he told me to do. When George knows a lot about poetry, and he has a vast, he has memorized vast portions of poetry. So he had some selections that maybe I wouldn't have thought of or found in my books, and I just trusted him on that. So
I have two questions, two follow-up questions. One is, you mentioned that you would, you know, say the William Harmon collection, the 100 Essential Poems, or I think that was what it was called. So you would read one of those a day and then discuss them. So briefly, in, you know, just a minute here, what did that look like? Did you gather, just, is it kind of part of morning time? If you would read the poem as part of morning time and then you discuss it? And what did that discussion look like?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it didn't look like anything. I would just read the poem. And I just made sure that they were hearing some poem every day. We were always memorizing a poem also. There could be a possibility of three poems. If you review an old poem that you've already memorized, and you are reading the same poem every day for, say, 3 or 4 weeks because you're memorizing it, and then you're also just reading a poem for the sheer, you know, joy of poetry, I tried not to kill that. That's one reason I like the classic 100 poems, because I could read through the information and just pass that along, or we could talk about the rhyme scheme, or not. If it had a really interesting rhyme scheme, we could say, "What do you think? You know, that what was that?" You know, the curfew tolls the knell of parting day, the lowing herd wind slowly o'er the lee, the plowman homeward plods his weary way, and leaves the world to darkness and to me. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when you get to these, that's the elegy written in a country churchyard by Thomas Gray. Sometimes when you get to a poem like that, it's 3 or 4 pages long, and it takes quite a few minutes to read. When you get to the end of that, that poem is so well written, nobody's really scratching their head wondering, what in the world did he just say? Everybody knows.
It's that Ezra Pound.
Yeah. No, that's right. But if you get to something that's inexplicable, you can either read it again. Mm-hmm. Or you can talk about it if you want to, or you can just leave it, because the thing about it is, when the brain grabs onto something inexplicable, it begins to work. And you can steal that work from the child, and every inexplicable thing will not be inexplicable to every child, because some of them aren't even listening while you're reading.
I guess you never know what they hear.
Yeah. You don't know who's going to. But I know for a fact, in my own mind, I will read a poem, and I don't even realize I don't understand it. And then maybe like 3 weeks later, my brain tells me what that meant. It comes back and says, "Oh, yeah, I get that now." And you didn't even know that your brain was working on that. But it did. Yeah. It was. I mean, I know that this happens. So.
Yeah, I think one of the things that it's worth remembering is that all of our minds, even when we're young, kind of are searching for sort of a harmony, right?
Yes.
So when we hear something in great literature, we see something in great art or whatever, our minds are constantly trying to, if we're confused by it or it's creating some kind of disharmony, we're trying to, our minds are kind of naturally trying to harmonize what we've heard. And so it's going to be at work. And great works that have sort of a harmony within them are great because they naturally allow us to sort of chew on, you know, the right sorts of things. So after a while, even if we don't realize that, we're going to get something out of it. And you know, and again, you never know what young kids are hearing and what it's meaning to them. And it might not mean anything for a long time, I suppose.
Yeah.
Did you find that your kids were generally pretty responsive to poetry?
They were. I found that they were. Some of them were not, but for the most part, I found that they, all of them grew up to find pleasure and meaning in poetry, at least, you know, I don't know how many
to some degree. Yeah.
I mean, some of them, older two boys would write quite, and my third son wrote poetry. My fourth son, they wrote their own poetry. And my one son, Nicholas, wrote a beautiful poem and I cannot find it anywhere. And, I'm really upset about that, but,
That's the worst.
I know. I've looked on all these old computer files and just cannot find this poem. And
maybe he's hiding it from you.
Yeah, he could be. He probably is afraid that I'll, you know,
make share it on the air.
Yeah, that's right. There she goes. But they did relate well to poetry, and they never, as manly as most of them are, all of them really. I don't want anybody to go, which of us is not manly? they're all manly. They never ever came across feeling that poetry was something, you know, feminine silly or shallow.
Yeah, they saw some value in it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they didn't all love Shakespeare. They didn't all love Shakespeare. I love Shakespeare, and hardly any of them just like Shakespeare at all. But they do love poetry.
Do you think that is that their appreciation for it is because you started young?
Yeah, I think so. I think they heard so much poetry, and I tried to. I mean, some poetry that we read did not reach, you know, great levels. I used that book of my grandmother's, which I've spoken of frequently, which was 101 famous poems. But there's some excellent poetry in that book. There's some, you know, just mediocre poetry in there. But they related well to those poems, and I think that really helped them. I mean, we've talked about Opportunity before by Edward Sill, and when they got to stuff like that, it felt, I guess, manly to them at a young age. That
yeah, this the Charge of the Light Brigade poem. And
yes, the Charge of the Light Brigade. What boy doesn't like to memorize that? Or girl? What girl doesn't like to memorize that?
Yeah, and you know. There's something about really good poetry too, the way good poetry has structure and there's a form to it that even if you don't understand the line, the practice of, the experience of hearing and the practice of memorizing, those structures and forms like can bring harmony sort of by themselves, even if they don't understand some deep concept that's buried in the poem. The language itself is still, meaningful and beautiful and can be sort of harmonizing in and of itself. And that's really valuable, I think.
Oh yeah. Just the feel of it, even if you don't even know what it's saying is often. And that's where, like, you think of Lewis Carroll. Some of this doesn't make a bit of sense, you know, what Brillig of the whatever, you know, it's just, but those actually work their way into your vocabulary so that, you know, when you're trying to say something that doesn't make any sense, you might refer back to some of that nonsense verse and actually embody some of the actual feelings you feel in your real life as you go along. And I think poetry has a unique way of teaching us how our brains make connections, because basically all poetry is making a connection from one thing to another, and it's such a powerful tool. Charlotte Mason says that all education is the science of relations. Well, poetry in itself is the science of relations. It's always relating one thing to another. Sometimes we have to grasp really hard to figure out. Sometimes it's super easy, you know, in some small poems we know, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? You know, well, that's not even a child's poem, but Yeah, we know what's being compared right there. He tells us right away he's going to compare the person he loves to a summer's day. But then he makes all these comparisons that maybe we wouldn't make. He doesn't just say, you know, the typical, oh, you know, your eyes or your lips or your, you know, he compares them to things that we don't maybe that are unexpected. And so we grasp after that to try to figure out, well, you know, what is he saying? How is this comparison working? And even
formally too, is the, you know, yeah. Even each line is a comparison to another line or it only works because of its relationship to the previous line. I mean, even like blank verse,
right.
That's what it's about, right? I mean, the point is the way the lines work together and create a whole. Wendell Berry in his book on William Carlos Williams poetry talks about how the difference between poetry and verse, between poetry or verse and prose is the new line. Like in theory, prose could just go on forever in one line, right? If it weren't for the limitations of the page.
Yes.
But
yes.
Poetry, you're making a specific choice to start a new line, and it's about the relationships between the lines and the sounds within the lines. So there's mm-hmm. a science of relations again right there, even just in the formal structural elements of poetry.
Right, right. Yes, definitely. So it just carries with it so much that is beyond. I mean, on one hand, it's very simple. You know, you have children's poetry. It also creates that culture, a common culture. Nursery rhymes are very good at creating a common culture. And then, of course, it moves on to metaphor. And then these deeper, like you're saying, it's saying something in a limited form. And yet that can become so much more powerful than just the, just to outright say something.
Yeah. Just a blanket statement. Okay. Let's summarize here. Let's wrap this episode up here. So in terms of your favorite anthologies, you have mentioned, the Oxford Book of English Verse, edited by Sir Arthur Quiller Couch. And you said that I looked on Amazon while we were talking, and it looks like there's a version that's like 1218 or something to 1918. So those 700 years of poetry, or 1250 to 1918. That one's available on Amazon. Yeah. Then the Classic 100 Poems, edited by William Harman.
Right.
And then you also mentioned the Harp and Laurel Wreath by Laura Berquist, which is a great one. We actually carry that one in our store.
Excellent.
All right. So those are great resources. We will put those in the show notes as well for people, with some links to Amazon or the different various places people can get those.
I recently talked about this, just not to interrupt. You're trying to close out the show here.
carry on.
I recently mentioned this in one of my talks, but if you haven't heard that, when I was the other, my brother wanted to watch a movie. He was at our house last spring, and we watched the movie The Darkest Hour about Winston Churchill.
Yeah,
it was a wonderful, wonderful movie. It really, really captured what was going on at Dunkirk, because from what I've heard, I haven't been able to watch the movie Dunkirk, because it's really hard to mess up such a beautiful, beautiful period of history. But apparently they were able to do that in the actual movie Dunkirk. But in The Darkest Hour, Churchill is trying to make, he gets this idea, he's trying to make a decision, and he's never, but he doesn't really know the common people. He's never really been out amongst the real world. You know, he hasn't gone to the store to buy himself something. And so he goes out one day without anybody with him, and he ends up on the underground. And he's on the underground, he's listening to what all the people are saying, and they're trying to help him. And I don't know how to explain it, because I haven't seen the movie in a while. I forget the thing. But suddenly, in the midst of all these people trying to say something, they start to, somebody on this bus, these ordinary working class people, starts to quote the poem, Horatius at the Bridge. And suddenly everybody on the whole, in the whole car, is quoting this poem along with Churchill. And it just captures everything about why English literature is so powerful, and why the English people are always so inspiring when it comes to these hard things in life, that stiff upper lip and the heart behind all that goes into making English literature so different from so many other forms of literature. I just thought it was a very powerful scene, and it really describes how poetry affects not just the elite person who studies literature in college, but just the everyday man, and how important it is to their life to be inspired. And that movie just did such a great job of capturing that I hope not only, it's a great movie about Churchill, it's a great movie about Dunkirk, even though it ends at Dunkirk, and it's a great movie about the power of poetry in the lives of our children.
Hmm. Well, you talk in your book about how more than one of your sons had poetry come to mind when they were in basic training or in training for different things that they were doing for the military.
Oh yes, all the time they did. Two of my sons ran a marathon, and when they would train, they would see who could go, you know, you say a poem, I say a poem, you say a Bible verse, I just see how long they could go just saying things that they'd memorized. Huh. And that's how they got through the marathon. And, and that's how they've gotten through lots of their training. My son Timothy, you know, he always, uses that when, especially when he was in really, really hard training, it always came back to the things that he had memorized that got him through, that took his mind out of, you know, the fact that he's carrying, you know, a 50-pound pack and he's, you know, climbing uphill.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then he, you know, one Dawn Duran mentioned the other day, she thought he said the poem "Crossing the Bar" when he was actually crossing like the international timeline or whatever that is, but he had been really, really discouraged at one point, and you know, that poem, he's out on the deck of a Navy ship, and he's that poem is what, you know, came to him and what got him through that really hard time. Hmm. So it's not, whenever I hear someone say they dislike poetry, I'm so sad. Yeah. Because,
or when they say it's impractical.
Yes. Or that, you know, it's a side thing. It really isn't a side thing. It is really, really, really right up there with some of the most foundational things we do in our homes with our children. They're really, besides Bible reading, it has to be number two. Besides the in my mind. So I would,
hey,
even
it's your
put
show.
It, yeah. It's,
you can say whatever
it's
you
my
want.
Opinion. So if you don't like poetry, it's just like someone who says they don't like Shakespeare. Well, I can tell you this, there's nothing wrong with Shakespeare. If you don't like poetry, just recognize it as a weakness in you, and a weakness that you can overcome by getting familiar with poetry. And you don't have to start with la-di-da poems that don't make any sense, that you don't understand. It's all right to start with nursery rhymes, even as an adult, because that's kind of like helping us to take baby steps towards understanding how wonderful and deep poetry is. But it also connects us like to the past. It also tells us what the people who came before us thought was important, or how they viewed life, and that's also a part of history that is kind of embedded in the DNA of poetry. So there's so much more that you get out of it when you're studying history, if you're studying the poetry at the same time of that period, or at least reading the poetry of the same time. You're going to feel things that you don't even realize about the time period, and have a much greater understanding of who these people were if you do that. Hmm. So don't underestimate the value that you spend on of reading poetry and have spending time with poems, because there's hardly anything else you can do that is going to be that produce as important. I want to say knowledge than poetry.
And you know, you mentioned people who maybe feel like they don't love it or don't know where to start, I think two great ways to learn to like poetry are to experience poetry with young kids, because when they memorize and love poetry, it opens the beauty of it up quite a bit. And then also that's, you know, but going back to the original question, that's the great thing about anthologies. If you don't know where to start, start with an anthology.
Yeah.
They've taken hundreds of years of poems and curated them for us to kind of start with. Okay. I've got Jeremiah right here. Jeremiah, what is your favorite poem?
Once There Was a Puffin.
The Puffin poem?
Yeah.
Can you say that?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Say it.
I need those.
You need the headphones?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hold on. He's a professional.
Yeah, I know. What am I thinking? Okay, say hi to Miss Cindy.
Hi.
Can you say hello?
Hi.
I want to hear this poem. Once There Was a Puffin.
Once there was a puffin, just the shape of a muffin, and it lived on an island in the bright blue sea. He ate little fishes that were most delicious, and he had them for supper, and he had them for tea. But this poor little puffin, he couldn't play nothing. He had nobody to play with at all. So he sat on his island and cried for a while. And he felt very lonely and felt very small. But along came the fishes, and they said, "A few wishes that could you could have us for playmates instead of for tea." So they all played together in all sorts of weather. And the puffin eats pancakes like you and like me.
Why do you like that one?
Because the pancake part.
Well, thank you for reciting that for
us. That was excellent. Excellent. And I think he has the perfect answer. It took something really absurd and connected it to something he loved, pancakes.
Yes, that's true.
And
exactly.
and what
all right, all right.
I love that. And I like pancakes too.
She says she likes pancakes too. well, all right. Well, let's call that a day. Let's end with a performance.
Amen.
Okay, well, thank you to IUW for sponsoring this show. They actually have some poetry resources over at IUW, so if you're interested in some of what they're doing, go to IEW.com/start. And thank you to IUW for sponsoring. Thank you to everyone who is a Patreon supporter of The Mason Jar. We have Cindy's readings and commentary on Charlotte Mason's books going up there as bonus episodes. So those are shorter 5, 10, 15 minute episodes. So you can continue to check those out over there. And if you have not become a Patreon supporter of The Mason Jar, you can go to patreon.com/MasonJar to learn more about that. All right, Cindy, thank you. This has been a great episode. Thanks for your thoughts and your expertise on poetry. And we will be back with another episode soon.
Right. Goodbye.